Hello, this is Angela Ewing with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio. Storytime, episode 21 of 9 O'Clock Horses. After 3 weeks in New York, I was back home in Redondo Beach. My friend Thelma had met me at the airport, and on the way back, I told her what had happened. She said, "I can't believe you'd seriously consider giving up your only child." "I know," I said. "I'm a mess." "It's just not like you, and I know you're struggling with the grief of Joseph's dying, but, oh dear, you have to keep on living for Jenny. She has no one else but you." Despite my resolve to get on with things, my life still did not seem real to me. I started to hallucinate, imagining Joseph's face in the wallpaper. I could see him often in the bedroom or living room. If I saw a man driving a car who looked like him, I had the notion of following the car. I was in total denial. I tried to keep my imaginings about Joseph to myself, since, even to me, it did seem weird. I had the distinct feeling of his presence. He was watching over Jenny and me. I was sure of that. I knew I was getting like my mother when I started talking to him. When I mentioned this to Thelma, she said, "You know, you need some help." A week later, she announced that she had made an appointment for me to see Dr. Robin DeVore, a psychologist who had an office on a side street in Torrance. I told her that was stupid. She said, "Well, I worry about you, you know." "Why?" I said. "Do you think I might off myself?" "Well, you did try it once." "Oh, don't be so daft," I said. "I couldn't do that, not now." "Nevertheless," she said, "please, go see this doctor." Thelma drove me to Dr. DeVore's office and told me she would be back in an hour to pick me up. She even waited as I reluctantly went inside. There was no receptionist in the foyer, and I stood for a minute wondering what I was supposed to do. Someone's voice came faintly from down the hall. I couldn't make out the words. Then a black Labrador appeared from the direction of the voice. My love of animals far exceeds my admiration for the human race, and I greeted the dog with a, "Hello!" He responded with an enthusiastic wave of his tail. The voice came again, louder now. "Is that you, Mrs. Levine? Follow Eddie. He'll bring you to me." I followed the dog down a hallway to a room lit only by a small table lamp. A man sat in the recliner chair in the center of the room. He was not at all what I expected a therapist to be. His clothes were disheveled, and even in the dim light, I could see his socks were mismatched. He wore dark glasses. Oddness emanated from this man, and I stepped back suddenly afraid. Only then did I realize he was blind. I heard myself take a deep breath. He must have heard it too, because he leaned forward and patted the chair in front of him. "It's all right," he said. "I need you to be very close to me while we talk. Will that be okay with you?" I sat down, and he immediately reached for my hand. "Now," he said, "tell me about you. You have some problems you'd like to share with me. Is that right?" I could feel tears sliding down my cheeks.
"I don't have any problems. You do. You're blind."
The man threw back his head and laughed. "I've been this way for a very long time. I see things just the way it was, with so much beauty in the world. How can I ignore it in my memories?" Well, that did it for me. My tears came uncontrolled. I couldn't speak. He didn't either for what seemed like a long time. Then he said, "I believe there are tissues on the table beside you." Now I felt foolish. I just wanted to get away from this man. I pulled my hand away and rose from the chair. He said, "Please, let's get on with this. You're paying me for my time, and I'm here to help you." Dr. DeVore listened. I talked. I talked about Joseph, about Colin, my mother, my brother, and my dad, the relationships in my life before I came to the States and since then. As I described it all, even to me, it sounded like a story that could not possibly be true. He said nothing, and I kept talking. When the soft ting, ting of an alarm clock sounded from the corner shelf, I was alarmed. Dr. DeVore squeezed my hand before releasing it. I'm sorry, our time is up. But I want you to listen carefully to what I'm saying. You know, it's not logical or rational to think that you're responsible for your mother's suicide attempt, your brother's sexual advances, Colin's death, or Joseph's. I want you to think seriously about the logic of your thoughts. You are not to blame. To dwell on the past as you do is very harmful to you, and oh, I'll see you next week. It may have been easy for him to tell me I wasn't logical, but to just forget, well, that wasn't possible for me. My weight was now 105 pounds. I was thinner than I had ever been in my whole life. I was totally flat-chested. I had no periods anymore. I had dried up inside and out. My grief for Joseph was different from what I felt when Colin had disappeared. Perhaps, underneath it all, I didn't believe Colin was dead. There was hope, but Joseph... I had seen his dead body in the morgue. It was final. I believe at that time in my life, it was Jenny who saved me from dwelling so much on the guilt I truly felt. She demanded my attention as most babies do, and I gave it to her. I received a widow and child benefit of $350 a month, and I knew we were not going to starve. But it was the dunning letters that arrived from the hospital that really bothered me. Phone calls at 6 o'clock in the morning, asking me that the bill be paid for the open heart surgery. I was really nasty to the poor girl at the credit department, since the bill was now well overdue and had been sent to the collections. I said, "He died during surgery. Why should I pay?" The problem, of course, was that we had no health insurance for Joseph. His military status had been 4F, which apparently told it all. Then, at a thrifty drugstore where Joseph had worked for a year, the employees had a whip round and presented me with a check for $1,000. I was overwhelmed by their generosity. They said they loved him, they missed him, because he made everyone laugh with his silly jokes and his infectious laugh. The $1,000 was sent to the collections department, and I presume the balance was paid off because I wasn't bothered again. I found a part-time job as a receptionist in a dental office. Edith once again stepped in to look after Jenny until my dog, Cheeky, my oldest minipin, became obsessed with keeping anyone away from Jenny in her crib. Edith said, "You know, she growls and bares her teeth, and when I try to pick up Jenny, well, I'm afraid. It's either me or the dog. I mean, one of us has to go." Anne, down the street, said she'd be glad to take the dogs while I worked. I had such good neighbors. I was still going to see Dr. DeVore once a week, and one of the things he imparted to me was that all the burden of guilt would eventually ruin my life if I didn't change my thoughts. I said somewhat defensively, "Well, that's how I am." "Then change you must," he said. "Your life has been traumatic. You must learn to accept the things you cannot change." It was at that time that my British friends Audrey and her husband Don suggested I go back to England for a while to be with my family. They insisted they pay for my airfare, and I could not dissuade them. In those days, for infants, BOAC provided sky cots that hung from the ceiling of the plane. Jenny slept peacefully all the way over the Atlantic. Surprisingly, it was a joyful reunion with my father and mother. I say that because I never really got along with my mother. and I didn't want to upset my mother, my father, or the routine, or even step on anyone's toes. My brother Douglas had moved into my old bedroom, and I was glad that I was able to comfortably say, "Well, I've arranged to stay with Ivy." Ivy was tall and blonde. She'd been a good friend since Fallville Girls' School, and we'd kept in touch. She had a son, Wayne, a year older than Jenny. Her husband was in Canada on business when I'd called her, and she said she'd be delighted to have me as company. I met my father quite often, since Ivy lived just around the corner. Usually, he and I sat in the back garden with a cup of tea. I could tell he was worried about me. "You're so thin, love. I wish you could go out more, and, you know, now you're here, you should enjoy some of the trips into the country. Why don't you go to lunch next week at Rothley Court? You know the restaurant there, it's superb." I laughed. "Oh, Dad, you mean on the back of your motorbike like we used to do?" "Well, why not?" My father smiled when I didn't answer him. He said, "I bet you miss your car, don't you?" I nodded. "Well, it's easier to travel to places by car when you have a baby, you know." He thought for a moment before he rose. "Come with me," he said. I followed him to his workshop that smelled inside of sawdust, not unpleasant to me. I remembered it from when I used to watch him working on various pieces of furniture. Now he showed me the intricate carvings he was doing on three sets of bellows for his siblings. They were extraordinarily beautiful, and his own designs. He poked around under one of the shelves and came up with an envelope. "Here you are," he said. "Take this and buy that car you want. You can buy one and have it shipped back to the US duty-free after 6 months. Only I'd appreciate it if you didn't tell your mum about this. All right?" "Oh, no," I said. "I couldn't take your savings. You may need it." "Well, I've never given you anything, love. I want you to have it." I hugged him and thanked him. I didn't look in the envelope, but it was thick, and I knew there must be lots of pounds in it. But he'd obviously set it aside for something. Not me, I was sure of that. When I discovered how much money was in the envelope, I wondered why he'd not bought a house. There was enough. It had always irked my mother that she lived in a council house. But he didn't tell me, and I didn't ask. Of course, in UK in 1964, you could buy a decent house for around £600 and a car for far less. After discussing what car he would suggest I buy, he said, "Well, I think the VW Bug is very good and it's affordable." I thought that was strange, actually, since it was a German car. A lot of Brits didn't buy German products after the war. My father thought that was stupid. If the product was good, why not? And since he thought German engineering was brilliant, who was I to argue? I flew to Munich, took a train to the factory of Wolfsburg, and ordered a VW Beetle to be made for America with a left-hand drive. The car made all the difference. I had been so eager to leave England, but now it didn't seem to be the bleak place I had once observed. Having a car of my own was freedom, except that very few people owned cars on Winstanley Drive. No one had a garage. When the council houses were built in the late 1800s, there were no cars. My mother said she remembered motor cars around the 1920s, but not before. People couldn't afford cars over there. Anyway, I parked my VW on the nearby cooperative store parking area, since the bus stopped directly outside our house and there was no room for any vehicles to be parked on the street. To this day in England, most houses in the suburbs do not have the luxury of attached garages. Some owners have cleared their front gardens to accommodate a small car, and vehicles line the curbs in some busy cities, causing chaos at rush hour. Driving in England on the left side of the road with a left-hand drive was awkward, but it served its purpose for the time I was there. I drove Ivy with the babies in tow to the countryside around Leicester. I drove my father to Rothley Court for lunch one day. He and I had often gone there when I was a pillion passenger on his big motorbike. He still liked those fine machines and could describe each one, model and make in detail. Rothley Court in Leicestershire is full of history associated with the Knights Templar and is mentioned in the Domesday Book of Records. The lovely gardens surrounding the place are beautifully kept with fountains and statues reminiscent of the former gardens still in manor houses today. The chapel with its leaded glass windows is a major attraction in the area, not to mention the classy restaurant that attracts tourists from all over Britain. I drove to Cornwall with another girlfriend when Ivy agreed to look after Jenny. Cornwall is in the west of England. Delightful villages nestle in the countryside among gently rolling hills and moorland, and fishing villages line the coastline, which in places is wild and windswept, with a history of pirates. The pirates date back to King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Delightful cliff-top walks surround the sheltered coves and fishing villages. It is paradise, at least to me. After 6 months, I made arrangements to ship the VW back with me on a Holland America cargo passenger ship that was to call at Panama, Haiti, and Bermuda. In those days, cargo passenger ships with more than 50 passengers had a doctor aboard. That suited me because of Jenny. The VW engine was steam cleaned at the docks before being loaded onto the cargo passenger ship in Southampton with about a dozen other vehicles. All the cars on board were classic or vintage cars, Rolls-Royce, Daimler, Jaguars and MGs, snugged up alongside my small VW Beetle. All vehicles were destined for Los Angeles or ports en route. As I stood at the rail of the large ship and watched the tender vessel swing away with my father on board, he tipped his hat. I stood on the deck and wept. Would I ever see my father again? Was it to be our last farewell? Our journey was to take 5 weeks. I was the youngest person aboard that vessel, except for a 14-year-old girl who loved to take Jenny with her stroller along the decks. The ship's doctor, a pleasant Dutchman, often asked me to join him on deck to sip brandy in the balmy evenings as we approached the Panama Canal. It was Christmas, hot and very humid. The ship was pulled slowly through the locks by thick cables attached to electric mules, sort of like tractors on either side of the narrow locks. Completed in 1914, the Panama Canal connects the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans across the Isthmus of Panama and can lift a ship 85 feet up from one lock to another. The three sets of locks, massive concrete structures 45 to 55 feet thick, can only be opened when the water level on both sides is equal, just like our smaller locks on the canals in England. Now the port of Cristobal in Panama connects a maritime route between the Caribbean and the Atlantic. On this trip, cars were unloaded in Haiti and Bermuda, and Bermuda is a fascinating island. It is the oldest of British overseas territories in the North Atlantic, dating back to 1707, when England and Scotland were joined, thus creating the Kingdom of Great Britain. Jenny was 13 months old and was just learning to walk. Fortunately, I had thought to bring a harness for her so we could go on deck. The cargo passenger ship is not like the glamorous cruise ships where the top deck is built for comfort, lined with glass and metal for the railings. This Holland America Line ship was commercial, crude in that respect, with huge gaps in the railings where anything that wasn't anchored firmly to the deck surface in rough seas could fall through to the ocean far below. When we finally docked in Los Angeles Harbor, to my horror, I saw when the car was unloaded. The tires had been swapped. The headlights had been smashed. I could only assume it had happened while we were docked at the port of Cristobal in Panama, where my car was inadvertently unloaded and was in the dock overnight. In any case, even though the insurance paid for the repairs, I never liked the car after that. I sold it soon after returning to Redondo Beach. I remember putting a for sale sign in the window of the car, and when I wound the window down, the sign stuck inside. I often wonder if the new buyer ever found it. When I think about that 6 months in UK, I realize it had been a time of renewed faith in myself that I would be able to manage alone with a child. And I'm not really sure why I ever returned to the States, except that I did have a lot of friends who'd stood by me all the time, and I missed them all. I also knew that I would have to have a place of my own if I was to stay in England. Sharing with Ivy was great, but I knew her husband would shortly be returning, and then what would I do? I was also aware that with my green card, I was supposed to be not gone from the States for more than 1 year without returning to check in at immigration. I had to come back. For the next 3 years, I worked as a part-time receptionist at an optical company in Redondo Beach. During that time, my father surprised me by coming to visit. He had never been out of England, and I was delighted and flattered he chose to come to see me. We went on a long road trip to Bryce and Zion Canyon. There's nothing like those places in England, and my father was in awe of the glorious colors in Bryce Canyon. Although England has a lot of open countryside, it's not the same. When we returned to the beach, I asked him what one word he would use to describe what he had seen, and he answered, "Vast. It's a very vast place." As I remember this story, I realize that in arranging it chronologically, I encounter moments of discomfort just writing it down. Perhaps all of us have had our times when we wish things had never happened. Meeting a man named Ruben Malkovich is one of those periods in my life I would rather forget. I had recently been taking lessons offered at the temple to become Jewish. My conversion led me to be a regular member at shul on Friday evenings, and I always seemed to be sitting directly behind a man who looked, from the back, a lot like Joseph, with the yarmulke sitting atop his thick black hair. After the service, it became habit to walk together to the meeting hall for refreshments. Reuben talked a lot about his job. He was a computer engineer at IBM, who apparently were one of the first in the computer industry. He was well paid. He drove a Saab and had a truck with a camper on the top that he built himself. I liked the fact that he was kind of an outdoorsy type of man. After a party or two at his apartment complex in Torrance, we became good friends, although there should have been a red flag warning for me at that time, because he made it clear if we went out, I would need a babysitter for Jenny. And there was always a problem of babysitters for me in the evenings, since Edith had moved to the Bay Area to be with her daughter. I had to rely on Thelma's daughter or another neighbor. Reuben was very attentive, buying me gifts and making me feel attractive. He said he liked to camp in the high desert areas like Corona del Mar. He confessed that he spent many weekends there in the nudist park in the past with a woman friend. When he asked me if I'd like to go with him, I immediately said no. I couldn't imagine parading around without a stitch of clothing. Then I remembered I had been photographed in the nude, although, you know, I never did know what happened to those photos. Reuben said it was protocol to go with a partner or be married if you attended a nudist park. He said he'd really like me to try it. Well, finally I told him I would, but Jenny would have to come along, and he said, well, okay. Surprisingly, I began to enjoy the feeling of total freedom. Couples with children rented a cabin, or they camped in a lovely park-like setting, which is what we did. Jenny was soon playing happily with the other children. Some of the rules were interesting to me. Not every woman went around totally nude, of course. Sometimes shorts and skimpy tops, or just shorts, were worn. I never witnessed any improprieties between men and women. Without clothes, there was no class differences. I knew there were doctors and lawyers and office workers there, people from all walks of life. Everyone could be totally equal, except that some of the bodies were not as equal as others, that's for sure. One of the things I did love about the place was the fact that you could take a shower so easily. Hoses were looped and wrapped from one tree to the other. Just bring soap and a towel. Enjoy the hot water, sometimes too hot. Wait a few minutes and you could have a cold shower. The place was well kept with gardens and an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Modern cabins were all around the perimeter. Campsites were in a separate area. I actually loved sleeping outside the camper on a sleeping bag on the ground. Looking up at the sky full of stars was magic. We were a long way from civilization of L.A., and stars out in the wilderness desert of Corona del Mar were extraordinary. I suspect, however, it's not as isolated now as it was then. Reuben paid Jenny very little attention, but I reasoned that he wasn't her father, so why should he? We met mostly at weekends, and I did enjoy being with him, especially on those weekends in Corona. I don't think our sex life dominated our relationship as it had done with Joseph. He was someone who seemed to enjoy my company, and although I found him to be rather intense, not really a fun person, far too serious, too careful with money, he was clever with a high IQ, and I think I admired that. When he announced his company was sending him to Ashland, Massachusetts, to be a troubleshooter on some new computer software, I expected him to leave and tell me he'd see me sometime in the future. I was surprised when he asked if I could go with him. I said, no, I can't go. I can't just give up my apartment and move. Not just like that. Well, he said, it's only for 6 months, maybe less, and you won't need to spend a dime of your own. You can save your widow and child's benefits. Wouldn't that be good? I thought seriously about that. What would be the harm in going for a few months? I even added up what I could save during that time. I suppose with that in mind more than anything, I said yes. He was delighted and helped me put my stuff into storage in Redondo. I stored my car in Thelma's garage, gave the notice to leave my apartment, and 2 weeks later, we traveled to the East Coast in his Saab. You've been listening to 9 o'clock Horses. This is Angela Ewing with KCIW Curry Coast Community Radio. Thank you for listening.